Yumi Steins here. On Ladies We Need to Talk, I speak to women about the big things that are going on in their lives. From overcoming health challenges.
She said to me, "Have you ever heard of the word endometriosis?" And I remember saying, "No, I don't think I have."
To navigating relationships.
I just said to him, "I need a break from you."
Search Ladies We Need to Talk on the Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
As police closed in on a man they thought was involved in the murder of Irma Palasek, they still needed evidence that connected him to the crime scene. And how they did this is a stark reminder to be careful what you throw away. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Just a warning, there is some strong language in this episode. Welcome to episode 8 of The Case of the Two Intruders.
Irma Palasek's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
We're getting to the pointy end of the prosecution case now, with Detective Sergeant Craig Marriott in the witness box detailing the investigation that has led police to this murder trial. In the room with the co-accused, albeit in very different circumstances, is ABC court reporter Elizabeth Byrne. Liz, thank you for being here.
Hi, Stocky.
And as well as Elizabeth, we're also joined by investigative reporter James Viver. G'day, James.
Hey, Stocky.
Liz, there is a lot to discuss in this episode. Before we get there, though, can you give me a bit of a run through of where we're going to go?
Well, this episode will delve into how police zeroed in on Joseph Facchione in the wake of Steve Fabrizi's arrest. And as this part of the story unfolds, you might think twice in future about what you throw away. Police have also revealed more details about their contact with Steve Fabrizi. And the court has released some interesting material, including the transcript of Mr. Fabrizi's chat with undercover officer Danny and images of the secret compartment under the Palasek's wall oven.
Thank you, Liz. Looking forward to going through the transcript of the undercover conversation in Crown Casino, and also talking about some of the photos as well. If you check out our socials at ABC Listen on Instagram and Facebook, you can have a look at them and follow along when we get to that point. But before all of that, Liz, the undercover unit of the Australian Federal Police, of the Canberra Police, has been very, very busy, because as well as creating a fake criminal network around Steve Fabrizi, they're also tailing Joseph Facchione, following him around, trying to gather enough evidence to arrest him. What were they up to here, Liz?
Well, Joseph Facchione decided that he would go on a trip to Cape York for a holiday. This wasn't unusual. He actually had travelled around Australia a couple of times at least. Anyway, on this occasion, which was in the 2020s, he headed off to go to Cape York, and he thought that he was having a nice little holiday, but he had some company that he didn't know about. And at one point, he discarded a coffee cup, and that was picked up by police and tested for DNA, and that DNA had been detected not just on the water jug in the fridge at the Palasek's 1999 home, but also on a balaclava that had been picked up at the 1998 burglary.
Got it. Yeah. And James, I know the DNA in this case is your special subject at the moment. Can you kind of just give us a bit of a wrap and the significance of some of these items for us?
Well, as Liz alluded to, yeah, it's the connect from the 98 incident to the 99 incident. And as we spoke about on the last episode, it's really crucial in terms of the timeline and in terms of what Joseph Facchione talks about in his involvement and his assertions that he has never been to Canberra. But a quick refresher for everyone, it's the balaclava that was left behind at the 1998 scene, from which tape lifts were taken, and later in the piece, DNA was extracted. what the prosecution's case is that that DNA is not a match, but in an extremely high probability, as we've talked about with those crazy numbers in the past, an extremely high probability on some of those tests that it matches the DNA taken from the water jug in the fridge of the Palasik's home from the incident in 1999.
Got it. And this is the incident where Irma Palasik was killed during that home invasion, when, as we've heard from her husband, Gregor Palasik, two men broke into the home and beat them both, taking $30,000 from the house following that robbery. Liz, the police tail Joseph Ocone, they get his DNA, they say it's a match to the water jug and the balaclava. Is this what they needed to arrest him?
It was, in fact, and Detective Craig Marriott, who was the arresting officer, went to Melbourne and collected him, and he was later extradited to Canberra. But this was a number of weeks after Steve Fabrizi had already been arrested. Although we know that Joseph Ocone did know Steve Fabrizi had been arrested because their friend Liz had told him.
Yeah, as we talked about in our episode on Tuesday. Liz, this is such a big moment in the case, in the investigation of this case. You know, Craig Marriott is working on a cold case from 20 years ago. There's been a number of different investigators. There's been different leads. There's been different dead ends, as we've spoken through. I mean, as he's describing this kind of breakthrough, is there much emotion? Is there much recognition of the significance of this moment as he's in the witness box?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as emotion. Craig Marriott is a very straight up and down sort of police officer, and he just delivered most of this with a lack of emotion, really. But he was definite, and I suppose he hoped he was convincing. But it was a significant moment. And remember, some fairly good detectives had come before him when there wasn't the same level of DNA analysis available. So there was Bob Peters initially, and then Jared Dunbar, who made a little bit of a leap forward, but he was the one who got to make the arrest.
Yeah. And I mean, we got a real insight into the investigation from Craig Marriott. It seemed like it didn't take police very long to work out who the Joe V that Steve Fabrizi mentioned to the fake crime boss is. They seemed to link that to Joseph Ocone quite quickly. How did they know they were on the right track?
Well, they were fairly confident, partly from talking to people connected to Steve Fabrizi. Remember, they talked to his former girlfriend, and people around Steve Fabrizi did sort of know who Joseph Ocone was. I mean, the men had quite a long connection. So it was relatively easy to establish that he was the person that Steve Fabrizi had talked about, but even though we sort of didn't know his full name, but they found out fairly quickly, and then they decided that they would tail him, and that's how they got the coffee cup.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I mean, you know, talking about this undercover operation to track down Joseph Ocone is one thing. The other thing is the investigation into, you know, who's travelled to Canberra and when. And something I've thought about a lot is just the technology and the tracking that is available to police now. In some of the other cases we've covered, on the case of, you know, mobile phone tower evidence is such a key part of that. Traffic camera footage is another key part of that as well. I imagine this was very, very different in 1999, but was there anything that police were looking at to try and track any travel by Steve Fabrizi or Joseph Ocone from Melbourne to Canberra in November 99?
Well, there are a number of things they looked at for both men. One of them was if they had bought something along the way, if there was evidence of transactions on that day at a particular time. Of course, there wasn't. They looked at bank transactions. They went to the banks. They did all sorts of things to try and work out where they might have been. I think the most intriguing one was that they went to the place that registered the trucks that went by on the highway at Gundagai. Joseph Ocone we heard from Steve Fabrizi, was driving his own car. And we know it was a big four-wheel drive. That's what other people have told us. So it might have registered there, they thought. So they went to check, but there was hardly any data for that particular time. And the reason was that there was an upgrade going on so that equipment could deal with the Y2K bug, which, if anyone remembers, I am actually the journalist who broke the story that the Y2K bug had not attacked Australia, because I worked that night, which was the last day of 1999. The Y2K bug was said to, as soon as we clicked over to a new century, was going to crash all the computers in the world, just about. In the end, in Australia, the only problem was a bus ticketing machine or something like that in South Australia. The rest of it was okay.
Well, and now the truck register in Canberra from late November or from early November for a period out of action because they were upgrading the system to deal with four numbers instead of the two, or what happens when it ticks over. So incredible way to date this whole experience, Liz, with a management of a Y2K bug. We've also heard about, you know, film cameras, the camcorders, all these other little bits and pieces that were being used. But I don't think anything places this more solidly in late 1999 than a Y2K process. Quite incredible insight. We heard as well, Liz, I mean, this is again kind of putting us back in 99, Craig Marriott going to the library to look at road maps from the time to make sure, you know, see what was going on with the roads. Why was this important?
Well, they had to work out, could they have driven to Canberra and back, as had been suggested, in the same sort of 24 hours? And he went and looked at the maps in the National Library that he thought that Joseph Focconi might have used to work out how to get to Canberra. In the end, it looks like it was pretty much the same as it is now, the same road, the same sort of amount of time.
Yeah, we did hear in the defence openings for Steve Fabrizi, the defence barrister questioning what the travel time would have been from Melbourne to Canberra in 1999 if it was the same as it is now. So hearing that evidence from Craig Marriott is really interesting as well. I'm finding it fascinating. You learn so much about this investigation from the lead investigator when they're giving this evidence. And something I found really interesting was just kind of the timing of Steve Fabrizi's arrest. He's arrested quite shortly after the meeting that he has with the fake crime boss, UCO Danny. Now, he was in Melbourne when he was arrested, so he needed to be extradited, brought back to Canberra. He gets on a plane with Craig Marriott, and it sounds like he really started to test Craig Marriott's patience on that flight. What was he doing?
Well, he was denying he had anything to do with any of this, and he kept denying it repeatedly until Craig Marriott said that he had to ask him to stop. And then about the time that they were going to land, so Craig Marriott actually told the court the seatbelt sign had gone on, Steve Fabrizi turned around, and Craig Marriott alleges Steve Fabrizi turned around and said, "I felt sorry for that man. I put a pillow under his head." And Craig Marriott said that he said, "I don't recall that pillow." And Steve Fabrizi said, "You should." So this sort of halfway conversation was happening as the plane was landing. And Craig Marriott knew he had to write this down so it would be part of the case. And all he had to write on was his business card. And in fact, he produced it in court and we saw it up on the screen where he had recorded this conversation that he'd had with Steve Fabrizi in the plane.
Mm. And is this, Liz, a change in what we've heard from Steve Fabrizi previously? He didn't kind of go as far as saying he went in and put a pillow under Gregor's head when talking at UCO Danny, did he?
No, we didn't hear that then, although he sort of admitted that he was there, but he didn't admit to that bit at the time. He didn't tell anyone. All he said was he'd gone in to help Joseph Focconi get out the window. So that was the extent of his entry into the house.
I do feel a little bit for Craig Marriott on the flight. It is not a long flight from Melbourne to Canberra. And so for someone to get on your nerves to the point where you just need to go, "Look, can you please be quiet?" I think we probably all sat next to someone like that on a plane at some point. Liz, did we hear if this was a commercial flight or a private charter flight that they were using to transport Steve Fabrizi?
Well, we don't really know. But if it was a commercial flight, I wish I'd been there.
So speaking of the strange conversations you overhear in public places, that would have been a real pearler. The undercover conversation, I mean, we just talked a little bit about this, Liz. How could police trust what Steve Fabrizi was saying? I mean, this guy is talking to a fake crime boss, someone who he thinks is a real crime boss. You know, this is involved, he believes, in a whole bunch of criminal activity. You know, how do they trust or how do they know that he's telling the truth or giving them legitimate information in that conversation?
Well, right at the beginning of this, when Bob Peters was in charge, he withheld some things from the public domain because he was hoping that when they finally found the person that did it, he'd find out from them those key details. And the details were the point of entry and exit from the house, which police knew was the bathroom window, that there were two dogs in the house, and of course the amount of money that was stolen. Mm-hmm. And all of this was, in fact, I remember asking questions about some of this at the time, but we were never enlightened. And this is the material that was held back from the public. Mm. So by the time, flip forward 24 years, and Steve Fabrizi volunteered information about that, and that's how they knew he had knowledge that no one else would have.
Got it. Thank you, Liz. I mean, speaking of that conversation with the fake crime boss, this is where Steve Fabrizi says he was at Irma's house in 1999. We've actually got the transcript of that conversation now. So the audio was quite scratchy when we'd been talking about it in our episode last Thursday. Now we have that transcript. We can actually get a fair bit more detail out of what that conversation was about, where they were going, particularly about some of the fake criminal activity that was done, that Steve Fabrizi was involved with. James, what were they up to?
Look, we don't exactly know still, but what we get from some of the language when it's in black and white on the page is some inferences around perhaps the types of things that were happening, certainly the amounts of money that were involved, and should we say the criminal credentials of UCO Danny. So let's start there. Very early in the piece, UCO Danny talks about having been born overseas. He talks about speaking fluent Spanish, that he has connections and family in Mexico and goes there back there quite often. That's one detail that certainly comes out of the transcript. There's lots of mentions of, you know, jobs you've done for me. There is mention of loads and shipments and deliveries, and that kind of thing are referred to during this conversation between the two. Talked a bit about last time where they were describing this job coming up. When we were talking about would UCO Danny or the crime boss dob Steve Fabrizi in for the reward that was being offered for leads into the investigation, which at that time was $500,000. And it was interesting to hear in that context about this supposed fake criminal syndicate job that they had coming up on the horizon. Danny described it as probably enough money for you to live very comfortable for the next 50 years.
Yeah, right.
So given Steve Fabrizi's age at the time, I don't think any of us would live that long, but nevertheless, that sounds like it was, you know, quite a big job as it was, or at least that's what they were setting up at the time. So look, we did get bits and pieces of details. Also, one thing that came out in the transcript that we weren't able to detect, you know, during our reporting in court on the day was that there seemed to have been some kind of recent involvement that Steve Fabrizi had with syndicate that had involved him actually going to Canberra.
Right.
And that there had been, quote, a raid of some kind. And there seemed to be some concern from Steve Fabrizi that him not having worn gloves during whatever this job was in Canberra was how police had got his DNA.
Yeah, got it. I mean, what is in the transcript is really a very clear display of how tense this conversation gets at times. In our episode last Thursday, James, we were talking about the kind of the cycle this goes through, the tension rising at certain points and then simmering down. And in this, you really see how tense it gets.
It really does. It's funny because you feel that tension when you're sat watching the recording, both the tension of the moment as it's recorded and replayed to us, let alone the tension of what's happening in court as Steve Fabrizi and the jury and everyone else watches along. Nevertheless, it's in a funny kind of a way, it also comes out on the page, just the extent to which Steve Fabrizi is willing to repeat what we now No, he has told us, sort of in a roundabout way, that it is a lie, that he had never been to Canberra, that he wasn't involved. And he repeats this lie page after page after page after page, you know, and he's pretty rugged in his denial of it. He says, you know, UCO Danny asks him, so you've never been to Canberra? And he asks it about 100 times, it feels like. and at one point, Steve Fabrizi says, Danny says, ever? He goes, ever, ever, never, never been to Canberra, never, ever. I never lived there, never, never passing, but never, never. First time I've been there, referring to this job that we had said before. And then he says never about 100 more times. So it is very repetitive. It is Danny just literally just hammering the same point over and over and over. But as I mentioned last time, there is a real gear change where Danny starts to become a bit more aggressive, and you know, the language changes, and it appears that seems to be a tactic and just a reminder about, you know, some of the strong language that we're about to use. He says, you know, don't treat me like, you see, Danny says to Steve Fabrizi, you know, you're telling me bullshit, don't fucking lie to me, don't treat me like a prick. And he starts to become more aggressive, and you know, he says, I can help you, but you got to stop bullshitting me, and you know, you're fucking lying to me. All that kind of language, it changes. And not long after that, we can see in the transcript the exact moment, and it is quite subtle in terms of on the page, but it is the moment that really, really changes everything in terms of this conversation. And again, Danny is just hammering this point, and then he sort of says, all right, I don't know what happened, but I didn't murder this lady. And he starts to go on and explain just slowly, slowly, slowly. And Danny says, but you were there? And then Fabrizi says, I help him, yes. And then from then on, the rest of the conversation, and we're sort of roughly halfway at that point, is Danny extracting in excruciating levels of effort and detail, but slowly, 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 tiny little bits of course, what he knows or suspects to be the case. And he's trying at great length to get every ounce of detail that he can, including, you know, one thing that we'd missed first time around, and that is about the four-wheel drive, the green four-wheel drive that Liz mentioned before, that they are alleged to have driven to Canberra in. And Craig Marriott, later on in Joseph Ficconi's police interview, asks him about that vehicle.
Interesting to get a sense of how this unfolds and how long it took as well. I mean, the transcript we've got is 70-odd pages. For them to kind of have this whole conversation, to listen to those denials till about halfway through, and then the rest of it just to be slowly extracting the detail that we talked about, you know, in this episode and the episode last Thursday as well. Liz, what stood out to you in the transcript in this interview?
Well, I think that turning point where Steve Fabrizi basically says he was there. Now, there wasn't just undercover officer Danny witnessing this. Unbeknownst to Steve Fabrizi, the police who ultimately arrested him were elsewhere, and they were listening in at the time. So that must have been quite an important moment for them as well. I thought the end of the tape was quite interesting. We get to the point where they've decided it's all good and Steve Fabrizi is going home, and he says to UCO Danny, see you Monday. And then he must have left, because Danny says in the transcript, okay, the time is 6:33 p.m. on Friday the 8th of September 2023. I'm now turning off the recording device.
Something that anyone who's listened to any police interview will be so familiar with, being at the sort of the start and the end of any tape. It's kind of strange to hear it in that context, right, Liz? You're not expecting it after such a long kind of informal style interview.
It was a very long conversation, and that was the sort of surprise at the end for me.
Yeah. Liz, not one to be constrained by the medium that we are working with. You've also managed to get us access to the photos of the crime scene at the Plasics home in 1999. We've actually put them up on our socials, ABC Listen, so you have a look on Instagram and Facebook. And looking at these photos, Liz, James, the house feels smaller than I was expecting. It's really quite a kind of 90s home. You've got carpet, you've got dark wood furniture and cupboards. I noticed kind of embroidered cushions, patterned rugs, wool blankets around the edges of some of these photos. And crucially, though, there are photos of the secret compartment in the kitchen. The oven in there looks like it's about bench height in the cabinets. And then under the oven, a few drawers that have been taken out, and then a compartment just above the floor with the lid about the size of an envelope that's been hidden there. Is that how, kind of what came across to both of you, to what stood out to you in these photos?
Yes, that's exactly what stood out to me. In fact, the thing that I was most surprised about is the actual hiding space itself. I hadn't ever seen it before. I'd seen other pictures of the house and how it was ransacked, but I hadn't seen that. And it really is just a little envelope size sort of top to it. And you don't see it until you've pulled all the drawers out from under the wall oven. So that was a bit of a surprise. The other thing, in my mind's eye, I had always seen the milk jug and the water bottle in the sort of top of the fridge, but in fact, it was in the door of the fridge down low. So I suppose I have to correct my thinking about that. But I've been hearing about that for so long, and then to see it was interesting. But you certainly can see from the pictures that the house was ransacked. And I might also add, there is nothing in those pictures that depicts any of the violence to the two people who were in the house.
Yeah, absolutely. James, what stood out to you in the photos?
Yeah, the secret compartment is so interesting. I mean, it's so intentional. I mean, we heard that from Irma and Gregor's daughter in the evidence that she gave quite early on. People might remember that from previous episodes, but obviously, you know, it is just so intentional and is designed, as Liz said, is envelope size kind of, I suppose, hatch, little kind of compartment that you pull out. It's got a hole in the section that pulls out, so you can sort of put your finger in and slide it out, and it's cut a rectangle shaped into the bottom of this cabinet, sort of through the chipboard in that photo that was given to us by the courts. Of course, it's a crime scene photo, and in it you can see the small white stickers with red writing on that are forensic markers, that are places where we assume that swabs have been taken or some kind of samples have been taken. We don't know what the substance is on next to the stickers in this photo. It is small spots of a darkish looking substance is all that we can see. I mean, there's a few other stickers sort of on the drawer and so on. And to see it is, yeah, I mean, it literally is revealing.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about the size of the house, a smaller kitchen than I was expecting, and the fridge, Liz, gigantic fridge, really, for the size of the kitchen, for the size of the fridge that I've got at home. It's probably bigger than the fridge that I've got at home at the moment. It looks like it was built in the 60s. It's like this sort of like really solid bunker thing. And yeah, Liz, as you say, the water jug, the milk bottle in the bottom sort of shelf of the door of the fridge. Was there anything else about the way that these were laid out or the way that the fridge looked that surprised you or wasn't what you were expecting?
Only where the two items were, because I had something else in my mind's eye, but just it heightened for me how a home invasion is literally that someone comes into your home and everything you've got is laid bare. And this was particularly so for the Palasics. Whether the two people accused were involved or not is another matter, but the home was ransacked, and it gives you a picture of what it must have been like for the two people who lived there.
And it is such a deeply personal set of images in a way, because like Liz says, it's every single item that we can see in these pictures is belong to those people, from, you know, the scotch bottle in the fridge, the water jug, the milk container, the blankets, everything that you've described. You know, these all belong to someone who was murdered that day. That's not in question. It's just who did it that is in question. And of course, Gregor too, so severely injured during the same incident. And so in seeing the pictures, it brings home that this was someone's home.
Yeah, The state of the house is, I think, probably what sort of shocks me as well. It really has been torn apart. James, as you describe, you know, blankets thrown over things, pillows discarded around places, you know, that embroidered pillow I mentioned earlier, it's just sort of sitting on a chair. There's just sort of stuff everywhere, all the cabinets open, all the drawers out, all of this sort of stuff going on as well. Clearly someone just kind of searching, tearing that place apart, looking for the compartment underneath the oven, potentially. Liz, these photos feel so personal. They're a window into the place next time that I really wasn't expecting that we were going to get. Are we supposed to have these? Are we allowed to have these?
Well, we certainly are allowed to have them. The jury's seen them a little while ago, and I sort of had to apply to get them. They were tendered as evidence in the trial, and when something's tendered to a court, it becomes a public document. So you do have to ask for it, but and sometimes it can, you know, the answer to that can be no. And in fact, there are a lot of pictures that we weren't able to have, nor could we show them on the ABC, because they were crime scene pictures which did depict the violence. But these are pictures that we are certainly allowed to have.
Great. Thank you, Liz. And appreciate you applying to the court for the photos as well, so we can have a look and we can talk about them on the case of, and also put them up on the ABC Listen Facebook and Instagram pages as well. So if you'd like to have a look, jump on them at the moment. There's a little carousel of images. You can flick through and have a look at what happened to the Play 6 home during that home invasion in 1999. Liz, now Craig Marriott is the person we've been talking about for a lot of this episode, lead detective on the case, giving evidence at the moment. This is usually something that comes right at the end of the prosecution case. Does him being in the witness box mean that we're close to the end of this trial?
I think it shows we're at the start of close to the end. I think there's been a few loose ends still hanging in the prosecution case. And part of it is there are some people who have to be cross-examined yet. Mm. But I think this signals we are getting to the point where we'll be winding up.
Great. Appreciate that, Liz. Thank you for the timeline update. Always very hard. I always feel like this is such a piece of string conversation. So you've answered that in a much more satisfying way than I was expecting you'd be able to. So thank you very much. We're getting a heap of questions sent through to the case of emails coming to thecaseof@abc.net.au, which is where you can get in touch. If you'd like to reach out to us, if you've got a question you'd like answered, please send us an email. thecaseof@abc.net.au is our email. And we do read every single one of them, even the ones that we can't talk about on the pod that we save for later, go through a filing system so we don't forget about them. But there is one I'd like to talk about in this episode. It's from Maggie, who's listening from the UK. She's asked about the undercover police operation. She's wondering whether or not police gave money to Steve Fabrizi for the fake jobs that he did for them.
Well, yes, they did, seems to have been the evidence, and it was part of reeling him in. He had quite a few interactions with the undercover officers. Now, there wasn't just undercover officer Danny. He only met him probably three times. There are a couple of other people involved in that, and they are the ones who got him to do work for them. Now, the police always have said to the court, no crimes, no actual crimes were committed in the course of this, but they had to pay him to make him believe we are a syndicate and this is what we do, and if you do these tasks for us, then you can, you know, work your way in.
Yeah.
And you got the sense that it was an ensemble cast, that some of the characters that are mentioned in the transcript that we've been talking about, Chris, Alex and some others, you know, these are all police officers, as Liz said, and so it was this script that they were following to create this world for Steve Fabrizi to exist in.
Yeah, got it. Thank you, James. Thank you, Liz. Wonderful question, Maggie. So thank you for getting in touch. I always enjoy the kind of conversation we have around some of these questions. Often the answer goes further than I was expecting that we would be able to go, or it's something I didn't realise that we could get into the detail of. So please get in touch, thecaseof@abc.net.au. After Maggie, we have another email here from Maddie. She's asking about the Hungarian diaspora in Canberra. She isn't sure how big this was when this crime took place, but, you know, she's wondering whether or not one of the co-accused being Hungarian was significant in the investigation.
Look, we haven't heard a great deal about this. There was certainly a very strong Hungarian community in Canberra at the time. They had their own club. When the Palasics lived in Red Hill, they used to spend a lot of time there. And certainly we also heard about the Hungarian community in Melbourne from Steve Fabrizi's girlfriend, or former girlfriend, I should say, She told the police that it was very active at the time, and that they'd meet at parties and things like that. So, and some of the interactions between the two men had been at those events. So there was a very strong Hungarian diaspora in Australia at the time. There was a little bit of evidence that Steve Fabrizi talks about in that conversation with UCO Danny, where he says there was a lady who talked to the lady in Canberra and knew that they'd kept money in the house, and she told her husband, and he claimed that Joseph Focconi had heard that information from the husband. Now, we don't know if that is true in any way. It's simply what Steve Fabrizi told UCO Danny. So maybe there was a relevance, but other than that interview, it hasn't come up in court.
Yeah, Maddie, it's perhaps not significant, but it's certainly a through line in the story here, that there is a Hungarian connection with sort of the main players and the accused. Just one bit in the transcript that with Steve Fabrizi that we're talking about, the secret recording, they both of the accused are Hungarian to an extent. Joseph Focconi, in fact, changed the spelling of his name because people couldn't get it right, that from the Hungarian spelling. But Steve Fabrizi is also, he says in the transcript, my mum is Hungarian, my dad was Italian. So he has that sort of split European heritage for what it's worth. And of course, the Palasics having immigrated from Hungary themselves too. So there is certainly a connect there. And as we heard in our last episode, Joseph Focconi played in goal for the Melbourne Hungarian club. So there was certainly at least enough people to be operating a small club and play football and so on.
Yeah, yeah. At least, how many in a soccer team? 14? 11?
11.
Yeah, there we go. So there's at least 11 Hungarian men in Melbourne in the time that Joseph Focconi was getting around. We are, in fact, actually getting a number of emails from the Case of listeners whose parents immigrated from Hungary around the same time as well. So lots of really interesting little details that have been sent to us that we'll be talking about in some of our post-trial episodes whenever we get to that stage. If you do have any questions yourself, any statements, any stories about your Hungarian heritage that you'd like to reach out to us with, you can email us at thecaseof@abc.net.au. Really do love hearing from you. And don't forget, jump onto ABC Listen. It's the best place to listen to The Case Of and a whole bunch of other wonderful ABC content. Liz will be back with The Case of the Two Intruders Thursday next week. We've got a Case of the Wheelie Bin Murder on Tuesday that we'll be bringing everybody. Where are we going in the next week or so? Do you know?
Well, I have a wish list. It's got one item on it, end of the prosecution case, beginning of the defence case.
Great. Well, look, there's a lot to discuss when we get to that stage. Thank you both so much for taking us through this episode. Be back in your feed on Tuesday. The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and James Viver and is presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, our legal queen, for her legal advice, to the ACT Newsroom, and also to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Wurundjeri people.